It's the Lost Mailbag episode. There were too many good questions that went unanswered this summer. We're going to get to ones about the Jared Goff, Sean McVay partnership and where it's headed, Aaron Rodgers' legacy, sizing up those Packers running backs, some classic David Letterman talk, and would you still watch football if it was flag? It's all on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. That is the name of the show that comes out on Monday now. And I'm gonna get this out at the top again. Starting this week, as you listen to this right now, your feed is changing. You are going to get the MMQB family of podcasts in your feed starting today. Andy and I are doing this show. We will do Mondays during the season. This is the Monday Morning NFL Podcast. We will also have the Deep Dive Podcast, the NFL Deep Dive Podcast, that will come out most likely on Thursdays during the season. You will be getting the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer. You will also be getting the MMQB Gambling Show. That will be hosted by Jimmy Traina of the SI Media Podcast. It will be myself, and it will be Scott Gramling, who is a gentleman I will have to meet. But that's exciting.
I'm excited that we get the name changes. You know, I've been wanting the name changes.
We do it. We like 10 things, and that was all good. But it is sort of a new era for the MMQB, as most of you know. So time for a little name change here. But you're gonna get all those shows in your feed going forward. If you don't subscribe already, do it now. You're going to want to listen to all that. I'm not gonna say we're the only NFL podcast you should be listening to, but if you like the NFL, you really should be subscribing to the MMQB family podcast. More exciting news, possibly even more exciting than that, we're going to do another mailbag show this week. This is the Lost Mailbag. We are doing a fourth one. We weren't gonna, but we had enough leftover questions that we decided we're just going to do one more before we really have to deep dive the preseason and the predictions and all that sort of thing. So, mailbag show, Andy. You ready?
I'm glad for it. And we're not talking Browns Hard Knocks storylines either, which is I find refreshing. Although, have you been surprised at the revelations we've seen on those storylines from Hard Knocks and the Browns this year?
I'm gonna have to back up just real quick and make two quick points. I have never watched an episode of Hard Knocks, and that's not because I go out of my way to avoid it. We don't subscribe to HBO in my household, and I just never went out of my way to. So I've heard what's happening. I get it through osmosis. I edited Connor Orr's little thing on it the other day, which was very funny. But I don't know what's going on there. I vaguely know what's going on.
Well, that just destroyed it. You have a second point? Because I don't know what else you have to say.
That kind of was my second point. I really can't speak about it in any intelligent way, which I guess you could say the same thing about my NFL takes. But
I haven't watched it super closely either. I think they do a good job with the show. It's still inherently a highly edited show just because how many hours they have and what they can show. But I would imagine the Browns will regret having been on Hard Knocks this year, because what we've dealt with, or at least the perception, has been worse than other teams before. The distraction of it. Coaches, do they get along? And Baker Mayfield, is he putting in the work? I mean, all these questions that come out of it, whether they're true or not, it's the perception that creates the distraction, and they're going to have to deal with that. And they're only two episodes in, I guess, or three episodes in now.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has ever liked being on Hard Knocks, though. So maybe that's just par for the course for that show. No one ever wants to do it. Let's get to the mailbag, though. Andy, we are starting. This first one's going to be from Tevin. How would you compare Jared Goff to the other young quarterbacks in the league, and what can he do to improve and possibly make the top 10 list for our show next season? And also, second part, what could year two of McVay's offense look like with defenses having a full offseason to study them and watch film? We do kind of overlook Jared Goff a little bit. I mean, not to the point where people wonder who the quarterback for the Rams is, but obviously I feel like more than anywhere, McVay is kind of the headliner and Goff is kind of like the co-headliner. That doesn't really happen.
And I don't think either guy's probably particularly thrilled with that either, but they'll take it because they're making headlines because they're winning games and winning their division. Goff is a very potential. He's not here yet, but I think what he can be is a very refined, high-level timing and rhythm player. I see a lot of stylistic similarities to Kirk Cousins, but Goff is a more talented version of Cousins. He moves better. I think both guys would move better than the average QB. They can get outside the pocket when something breaks down. He's got a stronger, more precise arm. I think he's a little bit bigger, so... he's a supersized Kirk Cousins, and that gives him pretty good potential, especially in a scheme that has been built around Cousins' strength because of McVay in Washington. I'm pretty high on Jared Goff, and I liked him coming out of Cal too. He's got a lot of the physical traits that you desire.
Do you worry at all? One thing, this became like the big storyline with the Rams because I think it's easily digestible for any even casual NFL fan. The big thing was like, oh, you know, they're getting the adjustments, the pre-snap adjustments in while McVay can still talk to Goff in the headset, and then will teams start disguising coverages late, and will that affect what Goff is able to do? Do you see anything like that, or really anything with this offense that would make you say, like, well, now that everyone's sort of had a chance to see what they do, you can expect something of a slide back?
No, I mean, maybe a little, but the offense will also continue to evolve. Remember that when people see the Rams, yep. The Rams also see them and they see what they're doing to them. And when you get disguised coverages, that tends to be more against balanced formations. And what I mean by balanced is just receivers split out wide pretty evenly on both sides. You're kind of not a true spread formation, but a normal looking formation. The Rams get in those condensed formations, especially out of 2 minute or their hurry up offenses, we're calling it. And when you condense the formation, when your receivers are tight inside and they're inside those painted field numbers, that limits what you can do coverage-wise because the spacing gets so distorted and you have to worry about receivers intersecting and crisscrossing off the line. That's why they do those formations, is you render the coverages more predictable. So you can't disguise against those looks very easily. And teams will continue to evolve with that anyway. Remember, Goff's going to get better as he goes along, and we don't know what McVay is saying to him exactly. I know that there was an NFL Films clip that caught 10 seconds of it last year, but we don't know if McVay's telling him throw here then here, or if he's saying, you know, our check into this, check into that. We don't know that, but here's what we do know is Tom Brady told Peter King when Peter went and saw him in Montana after the big Super Bowl comeback against Atlanta. Brady told him, yeah, we get to the line of scrimmage quickly because Josh McDaniels can be in my headset still. So yeah. Tom Brady's been doing it, and I would imagine McDaniels isn't holding Brady's hand. So I think this whole headset thing is pretty – it's not overblown because it is an important tactical approach, but the perception that it's the QB doing the work for the QB – or excuse me, the coach.
Yep.
The coach doing the work – that's a misguided perception. The coach is not just doing the work for the QB there.
Well, I actually would I'll make the take hot here. I will say it does seem a little bit overblown. It seems like a lot of teams across the league do that. We just all kind of freaked out because you know, everyone said, oh, you know, how did Goff improve so much? Something must be going on, and that seemed somewhat unique, and people sort of jumped on it, and now here we are talking about it.
Shanahan did it with Matt Ryan in Atlanta, and I would bet you if you get Shanahan in an ominous moment, he rolls his eyes when the world gives Sean McVay all the credit for coming up with this idea, because Sean McVay did not come up with this idea. Somebody else, and I bet you Shanahan didn't either. I mean, this is not a new revelation.
It was whoever was listening to Peter King's podcast after Super Bowl 51. That's where
it
came
all
from.
Along.
Next question is from Steven. I'd like to know what you guys think of the Green Bay Packers run game this season. There has been a change on the offensive line. Mike McCarthy has already said he'll use a running back by committee. And what are your thoughts on the three running backs, Aaron Jones, Ty Montgomery, and Jamal Williams? Just from a global perspective, we'll start with, what do you think of the run game in Green Bay, Andy?
I think it was average last year, and it needed to be a little bit more imaginative, and I was surprised it didn't become more imaginative once Hundley became the starter for a while. I understand that, though. You know, I'm not a big stat guy, Gary. This one's hard to ignore. Average yards per carry last year, Ty Montgomery 3.8, Jamal Williams, 3.6. Aaron Jones, 5.5. I mean, that's a huge, huge difference. So, and that doesn't mean Aaron Jones is the best, but that's, I would start there. I would at least start and examine that first.
I mean, Jones, you know, anecdotally, without looking at how many long runs he had, I feel like Jones is the, I mean, he's the sort of home run hitter in that group. I do think he's the most talented in that group as well. I'd be open to Ty Montgomery in that situation if he was able to stay healthy. But I think Williams is, you know, what he is. He's sort of more of a grinder, whereas Jones is kind of your more dynamic talent out of those three guys.
I think they all fit each other well. If we're to, and I'm still getting a feel for Williams and Jones. They were new last year. And they didn't have a ton of attempts. Williams had 153 attempts. Jones had 81 rushing attempts. So we're not looking at foundational backs. There's not a whole body of evidence on these guys yet. I'm surprised Montgomery has not become a more dynamic receiving threat either. He really has been, if you didn't know he used to play receiver, if they didn't let him wear that stupid jersey 88 that we've talked about, you'd never think of Ty Montgomery as a flex scat back type of runner. His yards and catches are almost nominal in a lot of games.
I just, and I think it's actually going to come up in the show again. Yeah, the Ty Montgomery number 88 jersey, that is a
travesty.
Pet peeve, greater than pet peeve for Andy. I side with Andy on this. I don't think it's worth getting all that fired up about. I don't get that emotionally invested in it. But my favorite thing about your beef with this, Andy, is look, Twitter is not representative of fan bases as much as we in the industry like to think so. We sort of overblow this and think it's this big thing. People on Twitter who are Packers fans get so upset with you over the fact that you get so upset with Ty Montgomery's jersey number.
They're sensitive about it. The scope of what's politically incorrect on Twitter, which is growing at an alarming rate already, has apparently reached all the way to jersey numbers on guys. Even the ones that are blatantly incorrect, like 88 on a running back.
It's my favorite like circular Twitter outrage thing.
Yeah,
I guess it's not that circular because I think you're not that fired up about people being fired up. But yeah,
it bugs me that it's such an easy fix. That's what bugs me about it.
Yes,
it's an easy fix.
See, and that's where I kind of agree with you because it is easy to just say, just switch it. It's you're not saying he can't wear a certain piece of equipment or something. It's just a number on his jersey.
Yeah, and people say, "Oh no, you got the jersey sales. You have to buy back the jerseys from the sporting goods." Yeah, it just switched the jersey. I get that. That's not a hard fix either for the league. Ty Montgomery jerseys are not flooding the market right now.
I'm just saying, I agree with Andy, but I can't match your passion on this. I just don't care about it that much. I get why it's problematic. I don't think it's it's terribly problematic. Of all the problems of all the problems of the world, Andy Benoit, we have other ones to fix first.
Yeah, this probably isn't even top 10 for Packer problems, and the Packers are a good team. I think I want to see Montgomery and Cobb become more – let's bring it back to football. I want to see them become more interchangeable. We see it at times. We haven't seen it super consistently, and I wonder part of that is Aaron Rodgers is so – my sense, I've never met him, but I think he would – tell you if you got some true serum in him. He's more comfortable reading the defense after the snap than before the snap. So maybe that's why they don't move these guys around so much, because when you're doing that and you're motioning and shifting, and that's all for pre-snap reads. Not that Rodgers can't. I'm sure he's great at those. He has to be. But he likes to figure it out after the snap. And so that's why Green Bay does all those spread formations and those ISO routes that people don't like when they don't go well. That's the reason, though. And so Montgomery, if Montgomery and Cobb were in the Patriots system, I think they'd be very different players.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a big year for Cobb, by the way. I mean, he's 27 years old. This is a contract year. This might be his last chance for a big payday. I'm sure he's one of those guys who's looking at what Sammy Watkins made and kind of said, you know, if I have 1,100 yards this year, I'm going to be a very wealthy man.
He's got a chance to. They're not a super deep receiving core this season.
they're not. And I do want to just back up real quick to what you were saying earlier before I transitioned so rudely. Moving out Jordy Nelson, moving in Jimmy Graham. I mean, I wonder if you are going to see, I don't want to say a new bag of tricks. It's not like they're going to blow up what they do and completely change it, because it's been all right with Aaron Rodgers. I think they are pretty happy with how it's gone. But I do wonder if you'll see some more some less sort of classic Aaron Rodgers make plays late in the down, bunch of ISO routes type of thing. And you will see some more heavily schemed stuff with this offense in 2018.
That's the Russell Wilson discussion there, and that's a delicate balance of how much you do that versus how much you let your QB go freestyle. And it's not, those guys, they'll tell you it's not freestyle. The Packers have very extensive rules for what your receivers do when Rodgers breaks outside the pocket. And the Seahawks have even more extensive rules when Russell Wilson does it. So it's just a philosophical question. I've learned to believe, Gary, that quarterbacks tend to be what they are, style, their approach. Like this Andrew Luck thing, is he going to continue to extend plays or get the ball out quicker? I think if given the opportunity, he's going to continue to extend plays because that's what he is. I think Rodgers, yeah, if given the opportunity, will get outside the pocket. I spoke with J.C. Treader a few weeks ago, the Browns center, but he was with Green Bay for a while. Mm-hmm. He said when he was in Green Bay, they had Aaron Rodgers blocking rules. And so a lot of time, if you're a pass blocker, if it's a three-step drop back, you're going to block that differently than if it's a seven-step drop back. You're going to be more aggressive on the three-step because you want to win early. You don't have to win late. Well, with Rodgers on three-step timing, because you never knew if he was actually going to play on three-step, might extend that play, you just blocked it the same way anyway. And that's a very, to a lineman, that's a hugely different approach. The other thing Treader said is there are times and Rodgers will go in the huddle and say, right side of the O-line, get beat inside because I want to immediately flood the pocket to my right, which is not how the play is drawn. You're not drawing up plays to get beat inside. So a QB that's got that kind of DNA and that kind of belief in his skill set, and more times than not, it works out. I don't think you're changing a guy like that, nor I don't know if you should change a guy like that. Green Bay, what Rodgers does works a lot. It drives me crazy at times as an analyst, but it works more often than it doesn't work, and it works in big ways.
That's that Treader note is very interesting because we talk about that all the time with Wilson and you know how difficult it is to block for Wilson, and maybe that's at the root of the fact that their offensive line is always so bad out in Seattle. But it seems like they figure that out much more effectively. Not that Rodgers and Wilson are the exact same guy, but it seems like they figured out the outer structure stuff much more effectively in Green Bay.
Here's one big, and I don't know if Wilson tells his linemen to do this or not, but the big difference between Wilson and Rodgers, and it just comes down to the simple 3 inches of height difference, is Rodgers is brilliant playing within the pocket. And by that, I mean his pocket movement, the subtleties in his drop back and his angles. He understands who's going to be blocked and not blocked and in what ways everything's vulnerable. His sense of pass protection understanding is highly refined, which is what makes it so confounding when at times he chooses to ignore it and play outside the pocket. Wilson does that because he has to at times, because he's never been a natural pocket guy because he didn't always see from the pocket. So that's the big difference. And that's why Wilson's probably, a lot of people would agree, a second-tier star, and Rodgers is a first-tier star.
Yeah. Let's go on to the next question here. This is from Gary, and it is from my home where I wrote it on a piece of paper, and now I will read it to you, Andy. And this kind of connects to your deep dive column, because you do the tweet elaboration most weeks, right?
I do most weeks.
Okay.
Depends how up against the deadline I am.
now you're worried about what I'm going to ask. I do want you. I want to talk about this tweet, and I want to tell you my problem with this tweet, which is partially with you and partially with the world in general. And then I want to discuss this. But your tweet was, Aaron Rodgers' reputation is a reminder of how winning a Super Bowl early in your career sets a positive narrative for life. Now, anyone who has known me or has discussed Twitter with me knows how much I hate Twitter. I think it makes people not only a little bit meaner, but more closed-minded and overall just kind of dumber.
Yep.
People saw this tweet and saw it very much as, I believe the kids would call it a subtweet, and then they would say on fleek and radical. But it seemed like you were taking a shot at Aaron Rodgers in a lot of people's minds. I don't think that was the case, though. Correct, Andy?
Correct. And it probably wasn't a great tweet because a lot of people took it a different way, and the words say what they say. The point I was trying to make is, if, let's say, when Rodgers won the Super Bowl, he won it, I believe, his third year as a starter, didn't he? 2008, mm-hmm. 9, and then year 3 was 2010 when they won it. If he hadn't won that, and that's a big if, of course, this is all hypothetical, but if he hadn't won that, then it's, well, can he would be the ultimate can he win the big one guy, would he not?
He would. At this point, he absolutely would, yeah. And I think that's a very good point. And, the same token, Eli Manning, who I think is a very good quarterback, has obviously had a wonderful career. The fact that Eli has two rings, but not only has two rings, but he won those rings against Tom Brady head-to-head, really changes the perception of Eli Manning. But,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, Rodgers, like you said, when they won that, what they won it in, it was the 2010 season, if I remember correctly, because that's the year went. They were 10-6 that year during the regular season.
That's the other point I wanted to make, is that was not, I bet not even close, that was not the best Packer team Rodgers has been on. They were 15-1 the next year, and they lost in the divisional round to that very Eli Manning, who won the Super Bowl that year. They have a 12-4 season in 2014. They've had better Packer teams before, but those are their only 10-plus win seasons, it looks like. It's 11-5 in 2012. It seems like you win a Super Bowl, you've got a pass for life, which is, we could debate if that's fair or not or even accurate. But imagine, like, Gary, I'm sure we've talked about this. Imagine if Brett Favre didn't win a Super Bowl in 1990, what was it, 6 for the Packers when they beat the Patriots?
Yeah.
Brett Favre had a pass for life after that. So he'd throw these crazy interceptions and play this loose gunslinger style, and it was all good old country boy in blue jeans playing quarterback. If he hadn't won a Super Bowl in his third year as a starter or fourth year as a starter, then it would be, who is this guy's reckless? You can't win anything with him. He's out of control. It's just, winning a Super Bowl early in your career sets an unbreakable narrative for almost everyone. The only guy I've seen break the narrative that, he's not what we thought, is Joe Flacco, and it's taken him 6 years of subtly declining play to do that.
Yeah, and not even subtle at some point a couple years ago. Yeah, Rodgers, as far as that goes, I mean, it would have been the same kind of annoying conversations that we had. Well, you and I didn't have it because we didn't know each other at the time, but like Peyton Manning first half of his career before he had won his Super Bowl.
Correct. It'd be exactly that. Remember that how much that dogged Manning? We forget that now because he won two titles since. Manning was known as Dan Marino 2.0, and they meant that in the negative part.
Yeah, and we look at we look at Marino now, and obviously everyone remembers his career very fondly and how great he was, and it would have gotten to that point in this alternate universe where Aaron Rodgers didn't have a ring, but yeah, we'd be having a lot of obnoxious Aaron Rodgers conversations if he had not won that title. So I suppose let's be thankful for that.
And we also want to, we've talked for a few minutes now, which means I probably didn't do a good enough tweet because this has covered a lot more than what the tweet even came close to. But yeah, this is everything I meant when I said that tweet, you morons. We want to believe that, winning the Super Bowl, it's this mystical thing. It's a heart of a champion. It's above everything else. It's not, when the Super Bowl champion teams they're not always the best team. They're the team that played the best at the biggest moment, and that's what mattered, and that's what the sport is. But this idea that there's something above and beyond about winning the Super Bowl, like it just touches a land of unknown of greatness, just doesn't work that way. The 2007 Giants, for example, were not the best team in the NFL that year. The Patriots were. The Giants were the better team on the day they happened to play, and that's how the game goes. But we mysticize Super Bowl rings so much when, in fact, those Super Bowl teams are not that much better than some of the teams that were not in the Super Bowl, or the teams they beat to get there even.
Yep. Andy, before we move on, just a quick note here. Only with NFL Game Pass do you get every out-of-market preseason game live. Top rookies, comeback players, new players on new teams. It all happens in the preseason live with NFL Game Pass. You know what I'm excited about? Seeing more Sam Darnold. We say it on the show a lot, you know, preseason or regular season, it's not apples to apples because coaches won't roll out all the complex things they're going to do during the regular season. But watching Darnold in the preseason, you can see how quickly his eyes are moving and how fast he's processing on the field. That's a great sign for the future if you're a Jets fan, and certainly a thrill for anyone who appreciates good quarterback play like I know all of you out there do. With NFL Game Pass, I can watch Darnold live in the preseason, and if I miss a game, I can replay it after it's aired. Whoever you want to watch this preseason, you'll need NFL Game Pass to do so if you're out of market. Who among Darnold, Baker Mayfield, and the rest of those rookie quarterbacks will claim a week one starting job? Is the chemistry going to be there between Cam Newton and his first round receiver, DJ Moore? Is Case Keenum the guy to get the Broncos offense back on track? Make sure to watch all the action this preseason with NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2018 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Sign up now at NFL.com/MMQB10things. That's MMQB10things. Game on. And, you know, Andy, we say it all the time on the show. If you enjoy the show, which I assume you do if you listen to it this deep into the mailbag, get NFL Game Pass. It really is such a great tool for learning football and getting to see the things that you can't see. The coach's film is something you really can't get it anywhere else. So even if you're, you know, doing more of an amateur style sort of analysis of the game, it's such a really cool tool to be able to see all this stuff. So again, NFL.com/MMQB10things10things. You agree with me, right, Andy?
I do agree with you, and I have used Game Pass a lot over the. There have been years I use it at the combine. And I'll set it up with coaches when we sit down, and they'll say, "Oh, what's this?" It's a good product. It's a tremendous product. It really changed a lot of things for my career when they put that coach's film on there in 2012.
Next question is coming from Dante. He actually has a two-part question, and the second one is probably more important than the first. Fun little question here. Who would you pick to start a franchise with right now if it wasn't a quarterback? Dante says he would. He thinks he'd go with Von Miller over Jalen Ramsey. Let's answer that, and then I'll get to part two of the question, Andy.
Okay, that's a good question. Ramsey's bugging me lately. This whole the spouting off in the media, I don't think it's that big a deal, but it's just enough that I don't know if I'd want to start with Jalen Ramsey. I would go. I would take Jalen Ramsey's physical abilities, I guess, if I could find a guy that would do that. But would you go offense or defense if you don't have a QB? You probably have to go defense, wouldn't you, if you're not
defense,
taking a QB?
Yeah,
because your offense will take the shape of your quarterback no matter who's around him. Go defense. Is Luke Kuechly young enough to count? I guess he's had the concussion issues, so
yeah,
maybe you don't want to.
I was thinking Kuechly. I was also going to go Khalil Mack. I'd probably lean Mack because of the age thing. I think Mack might have a little more in the tank than Kuechly. I mean, I think they both have plenty left in the tank, but I think Mack might give you another two or 3 years more than Kuechly would.
John Madden and Al Davis used to have these debates because Madden believed you started a team up front in the trenches, and Davis believed you started them with cornerbacks. And that was years ago. That was before it was a passing league. So I'm sure Al Davis, if he were here today having these discussions with John Madden and they were working together, would be even more adamant. And he might have Madden on his side now. I would be tempted to start it with a true shutdown number one corner, which means maybe I would take Ramsey and just hope he matures a little and stops sharing his, frankly, uneducated opinion on every guy in the league. Somewhat uneducated. He hasn't faced all the quarterback you talked about.
Yes. The Ramsey stuff, it was a little bit silly. I mean, I think we're both sort of in the same camp. We don't mind it that much. It does seem like they are, and Albert Breer written about this the other day on our site on themmqb.com. It's almost like a Seahawks South sort of, you know, not only style defensively and schematic, you know, scheme-wise what they do down at Jacksonville, but they're almost trying to sort of like have that same sort of attitude too, that sort of be who you want to be type of thing, and we'll get it sorted out as long as you do the work. And obviously Ramsey is getting it done as far as the work goes down there, and they seem to feel fine about him. Before all the super hot takes on quarterbacks, he was suspended for some picking a fight
right.
with the media after some stuff that all seemed a little bit petty. I really appreciated the fact that he was suspended. He was punished by being suspended for a preseason game, whereas up in Cleveland, Hugh Jackson said he was punishing Antonio Callaway by making him play in a preseason game.
Yeah, and we can debate the intelligence of that kind of approach, but that suspension to Ramsey, which isn't it's a slap on the wrist at most, I get
yes.
it, but the symbolism of it tells me that it might not be a Seahawks call, that we don't want you to be who you are because you've been bugging the crap out of us lately. There's no way they suspended him strictly for that Twitter tirade towards the reporter, which was uncouth, but not threatening or outrageous or a Twitter tirade.
I could see a slap on the wrist punishment like that. You can't have guys going after the media for something incredibly silly. I mean, it's not a great idea to go after the media anyway. The media as whatever your perception is
We're
of the
powerful.
Media.
We are powerful men. Yeah,
we are incredibly powerful. But more, it's like that is... Look, they are shaping a narrative around your team for better or worse. So it's like you might as well get along with them if you can. So to pick a fight over something like that is a little bit silly. You'll hear media relations guys, you talk to them, they always say, if you have a problem with someone in the media, come to media relations and then we will sort it out. Don't be spouting off on social media or yelling about the media in interviews and stuff like that. But I think it was, it's a slap on the wrist punishment. Symbolic, but I don't know. I don't know if that's like a big time deterrent at this point.
So
it's
you
a
start
deterrent,
your team
but
with...
not that much of a
okay.
deterrent.
So we say we start our team with Ramsey and just move on? Because I would probably take the most talented
right.
cornerback.
That was,
and just, yeah.
That was the question,
I think I would
it?
Go Ramsey. Yeah, it was. Well, yeah, I think I would go. Xavier Rhodes is 28, so you can't start a team
yes.
with a 28-year-old cornerback.
Correct.
Even though I put him number one ahead of Ramsey, or I have Ramsey a close number two. Ramsey is 23 years old. He turns 24 in October. I'm starting my team with Jalen Ramsey right now.
Dante also wanted to know, and this is how you know Dante has been listening for a long time. He said, I was listening to an old show. Did Andy ever set Gary up with a meeting with Rupert G of Hello Deli? Rupert G, of course, of David Letterman fame, who Andy became very close with. Very close with.
Not very. We went to dinner one time. We went to dinner, and I remember this is one of the funnier things I had heard, because he was dead serious when he said this. One thing that always amazes me at New York is the pedestrians stand so close to the street, and the mm-hmm. cars downtown, especially the cab drivers, go 45 miles an hour through these one-way streets. It's incredibly reckless. And I said, don't people, isn't that dangerous? Don't people get hurt? And then he goes, oh yeah, every once in a while someone gets run over. And he said it just so casually. And I thought, and it's like, of course people get run over. And that was we went to dinner early because he closed his deli at a weird hour it had like a window. So we had like a 5 o'clock dinner. So we were the only ones in there. And it was kind of a candlelight restaurant, if I recall. And he was telling about people getting run over in the car. And I think that was the last time I saw him. I've been to New York probably 15 times since. And I did think about him when I went there a few weeks ago, but I was way down by Wall Street. I was not up by 56th Street,
yeah.
which I believe is where his deli is.
Yep.
So anyway, no. The question is, I've set you up, and the answer is no. If you wanted me to, I would, but you'd have to not leave town when I'm in New York like you did last time.
I know.
And you'd have to be willing. I'd probably have to jog Rupert's memory by now and say, remember, I'm the football writer guy. And you know who the other guy is that he knows, like the way he knows me? And he knew him as a kid, and the guy was a writer.
Who's
Max
that?
Kellerman. Max Kellerman.
Oh, yeah? Interesting.
Yep. He told me about Max Kellerman before he was known. He said, I know this other kid. He's a boxing writer. And he comes in here. Mm-hmm. And Max Kellerman's not a kid anymore. This was years before me. So Rupert G is – he ought to be a media agent or something.
He really is. And look, I will never meet him because I was a huge Letterman fan. Well, Letterman's still around. I still like Letterman. I was a huge fan of The Late Show when I was in high school, and Rupert G was obviously a fan favorite with all the hidden camera stuff they used to do with him. That was absolutely hilarious. But if I met him, I'm awkward anyway. So if I met him, I'd be super awkward, and I'd just sort of be
like, "Would you really?
Remember that time you were in Wendy's and you ordered the double Wendy's with the Wendy's sauce?" And then it would be like an awkward silence, and we'd quietly walk away.
He does not like that. He's not comfortable in the spotlight. Like how uncomfortable he looked on TV. That's how uncomfortable he really is.
I could imagine that's basically what his life was for probably like a decade at least. Just
we're
people
coming
up to him and talking about that. But
I want to see you meet him now. So when I'm there, maybe for the holiday party, we'll do that.
We'll see. I'll really have to build up my nerve. But
That's ridiculous. Yeah. Come on. You've met NBA players. You meet NBA guys that are twice your size. He's a little smaller than you.
But none of them were ever on Letterman. Well, LeBron was probably on Letterman at some point, but I didn't
Ooh,
see that episode.
Humble brag. You've met LeBron? Wow,
Me and LeBron are very close. We've been in the general vicinity of each other like three times. He even I think he has spoken like a total of 14 words to me over the course of his life and my life. So pretty close, yeah.
But you didn't get nervous for him, did you?
No, he was also, that was when he only had like one or two rings was the last time I saw him. So he still only has, he has three now, right?
I've lost.
That's how much I
he had two with the Heat. He had two, he's got three. He had two with the Heat,
and
he has one with the
Cavs.
So. But he's been in so many that nobody says that, do they? He only has, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, especially we're football guys, but he only has three rings. People don't say it that way.
One of those rings he got with a not very good team, and he's always in the finals. People bust on him for making the finals and losing, which is just insane to me. But just to wrap up Rupert G., of the Hello Deli, I'm not going to be able to track down the episode. I don't know. It's when Andy and I first started doing the show, but I distinctly remember when you started telling the story of meeting Rupert G and knowing Rupert G and all that stuff, Andy. I sat there in disbelief, and I was waiting for you to say this is completely made up, like someone had put you up to it to tell me that you were hanging out with Rupert G.
My response is, I bet 80% of our listeners don't even know who we're talking about. We're trying
to this has
move
gone
along.
Off the rails.
Rupert G was mildly famous, well, kind of pretty famous, 12 years ago, 15 years ago.
I think we can get to three more questions here before we wrap it up. This first one, this is actually, we had talked about during the cornerbacks and the safety show, cornerbacks turning into safeties late in their career. Two friends of the show just dropped us lines to remind us. Devin McCourty, Rodrigo tells us Devin McCourty obviously moved to safety after, I think, just rookie year at cornerback in New England, but he moved very early in his career.
He was there a few years at corner, but he wasn't a late in the career thing.
Michael D points out D'Angelo Hall went from cornerback to safety. Obviously, Hall was really injured the last 2 years. And I do want to mention real quick, I spoke to D'Angelo Hall for we're going to have an exit interview piece coming up with him in September. And I really, the biggest reason I wanted to do the interview, one, he's a really entertaining guy, but two, I wanted to ask him specifically why he was able to move to safety. One thing he brought up was that, later in his career as a cornerback, a lot of coaches sort of relied on him to make sure alignments were correct in the secondary and make sure communication was getting done with some of the younger safeties he played alongside. And he thought that was a big deal. And one of the reasons he was able to move to safety is he had already been doing some of the communication type stuff that you have to do as a safety, and he thinks that's a detriment to some guys who are maybe the, you know, the Revis Island type of guys. Well, we'll talk about Revis specifically, but Revis Island type of guys who are more of the put me out there, I'll lock down my guy, don't worry about anything else going on type of guys.
That's really interesting. You don't often see cornerbacks as the communicators in the secondary because, for one, safeties have a more balanced picture of the whole formation, but two, is the cornerback on the other side of the field's too far away to hear that cornerback who's calling the signals. So that's why the safeties and middle linebackers are the guys, because there's everybody can hear them because they stand in the middle of the field near everybody. So that's interesting that he had communication responsibility. He's had a nice career. I'm sure he's bothered a lot of people along the way. He's outspoken. He probably thought he was more than he was for a few years there, but he was a really good cornerback for a handful of years, and then he transitioned well and had a nice career as, I'd say, a two-part safety. I think he was pretty good in the box, a better tackler than you'd ever guess, and he lasted a while as a free safety. He had a nice career.
He is. He was an excellent – we talked for like 2 hours. It was an excellent interview. One of the things he said, you know, he's kind of like – he's very satisfied with his career. He's happy to be retired, very, very happy and all that. But he kind of said, like, you know, I wish I was a Hall of Famer, but I don't think I was. If they vote me in, I'll be happy. But I thought that was kind of refreshing because a lot of guys are kind of, you know, they wrap up and they kind of say, like, oh, I'm a Hall of Famer, I'm going to the Hall of Fame. And he was a little more realistic about it. He knows he had a really good career, but he's not, you know, he's not getting sized for the jacket in Canton right now. So
no, I think he was a 3-time Pro Bowler.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? I mean, that's he's not going to be even one of the nominees or in the 25-man discussion one day. But that, there's no shame in that either. We act like it's like if you're not in the Hall of Fame and you had a bad career, there's no shame in not being in the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame is a different class. It's pretty limited.
Especially the Football Hall of Fame. They actually limit it, unlike some of these other sports. Rodolfo asks, and Andy, I know you're going to get upset about this because we've addressed it before, but Rodolfo asks, why not a podcast about the top 10 offensive defensive minds in the NFL, or just a top five mailbag show about it? You know, I know you're going to say, like, we addressed this 14 years ago, Andy, but we don't do it. It's just, I mean, we're not crazy about ranking players anyway. And to do it with coaches, there's just so many variables. It becomes so complex. It's just, you can't do it in any reasonable way. I do want to ask you, Andy, though. We have talked all offseason, and we'll probably keep talking about Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan, and how everyone basically is looking at their offenses and saying, that's what we want to do. Is there anyone else in the league who you would say there's a buzz about on either side of the ball right now?
On either side of the ball? I mean, Sean Payton always has to respect the people. I'm sure people respect Bill O'Brien and what he did last year to Deshaun Watson. Belichick always has the respect. So it's the old guard stuff. But, yeah, the reason we don't rank these coaches is because so much of what they do is dependent on others. So they might not run a certain scheme because they know that they can't trust player X to do that. And there's no way for us to know that they know that, versus how you watch on film and we can see player X and is so much of it's athletic based. When we're watching him, you can surmise a little bit more of what he's doing and why he's doing that. Coaches, you cannot. So I can think of coaches who are good and some who I would bet are not as good, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, it's a little bit of a guessing game with it. I don't know, to answer your question, though. The only names I heard this year were McVay and Shanahan. That doesn't mean others aren't being talked about, but those guys are being so much more talked about within the league right now that it's almost set aside. Dan Quinn, people talk about Dan Quinn a lot. It just depends. Coaches, we talked about this last week. Coaches really respect other coaches. So there's a lot of praise that goes around in the NFL.
Last question, Andy. Last question of the summer mailbag. This is from George. And I do, Andy, do not blow this question off. I do want to know your answer. George asks, in a hypothetical, and I will presume dystopian, NFL future where hits and tackling are outlawed, so it is flag football, how interesting tactically would the NFL still be to you?
I've thought about that before because when I was a kid, my parents said they're going to outlaw football because it's so dangerous, and it scared me at the time. So I've thought about this in the back of my mind for my entire life. I don't know if it would be. I mean, it would be very tactically different. It becomes so much of a passing league that it'd just be all coverage based. So that's hard. I mean, it's I'm going to blow off the question because what do you do with the pass rush? If it's flag football, do we still have pass rushers and run blockers?
I mean, it would be kind of 7-on-7. And I admit I didn't watch any of the flag football stuff that NFL Network was showing this past spring, so I'm not that knowledgeable about it. But I think it just, you know, it becomes basically 7-on-7 drills, but now competition.
Is this really, do we not have another question we can end on a stronger note here?
What I thought that was a very interesting sort of large view picture. I mean, let's take man, you're really putting the pressure on me, Andy. Let's go Panagiotis. Most would agree Jared Goff would have been labeled a bust had he had a second year similar to his rookie year. Is it possible many of the high draft busts at quarterback were called so because it landed on teams with bad organizations or subpar coaching? Andy, how's
yes.
that one?
The answer is yes, and that's an easy one. We're going to end with a Goff question after beginning with a Goff question. I guess it's better than ending with a make-believe flag football situation.
I can't believe you. You said it's something you thought about, this dystopian future.
I thought about how awful it'd be.
Okay.
And then I never thought, how would the game change? I've thought, would I still like football if it were flag?
Yes.
And then I usually, before I get to the end of the answer, I've thought of something else. It's more of just a latent fear that I have within me, a latent fear within me.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your answer? The Goff one's an easy one, isn't it? If certain bust quarterback QBs have
it's
been
pretty
bust,
easy.
Coaches are, yeah, I mean, of course, the answer is absolutely. The question is, what percent of them would be better?
Yeah, I've been thinking about Paxton Lynch a lot because it looks like that is going just worse and worse in Denver with him, and I think it was too many coaching changes with him, and he was a guy who was too much of a project to handle that many coaching changes.
Yeah, I would agree, and we knew that's what he was coming into the NFL. The skill set is there, but the skill set is such a small part of it. You have to be able then to apply the skill set into situations. Can you throw the ball with a pass rush and bodies around you while you're processing coverages, and not just coverages, but then your play and what your play is and how those two things relate? That's a whole different world. And what we're talking about there, a lot of that comes in to coaching and the communication. Just think back to how you felt as a student when you were in a class taught by your best professor who believed in you, and you were in a class taught by your worst teacher who didn't believe in you and who was kind of a dud. You feel like a very different student in those two different setups. It's the same thing, probably on a more magnified scale because you add in the physical dimension of football. It's the same thing in football, though.
All right. That's a wrap. Thanks, as always, to producer Shelby Royce and all the guys at Cadence 13 to make it sound so good. Most of all, thank you to listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You guys are the best, Andy, and I want to hear from you. Keep those questions coming. We'll take them during the year. Andy_Benoit, GGremling_SI, or email talkback@themmqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to the MMQB Podcast family wherever you listen to podcasts, including themmqb.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.